This is H. Tracy Hall, Sr. Today is Sunday, July 14th of 1991. I'm in the process of copying the 7-inch tapes from our old woolen sack recorder onto the more modern cassette format. The date of the original tape was February 8, 1965, and it's a tape in which I told the diamond story. I'll now proceed to record the tape from the woolen sack by letting its audio output just go over and go in the microphone of my newer tape recorder.
I'm going to try to get Tracy Hall to tell a story of his man-made diamonds or the family.
That's out of rules.
He has the flu today and is home from work, and that is why his voice will sound hoarse.
Adelza's statement was made yesterday. Today's the 21st. And I think she's finally cornered me, and I might have to do what she wants me to do. In October of 1948, we accepted the position as a research associate at the General Electric Company in Schenectady, New York. During September, I had considered several job opportunities, had traveled to Rochester, New York to talk to the Eastman Kodak people, had talked to Hercules Powder Company people, Allegheny Ballistics Lab in Cumberland, Maryland, and had talked with DuPont people Virginia, New Jersey, and Wilmington, and had also talked to people in the Bakelite Corporation, Bound Brook, New Jersey. Peculiar thing, all of these people wanted to give me a job, but General Electric didn't. As a matter of fact, when I had written to General Electric, they told me there's no point in coming to Schenectady for an interview. But I wrote to them and told them I was passing by anyway, and would it be all right if I stopped off? They reluctantly said okay. So I did stop off, and I apparently didn't make too good an impression with the man who headed the chemistry department, Abraham Lincoln Marshall, and with other officials, but did make a real good impression with a fellow by the name of Cass, William Cass, who at that time seemed to be up and coming in chemistry department and was assisting in a lot of their recruiting activities. Cass told me at the time he didn't think that the management was giving me a fair shake, but he was sure going to try and convince them that they ought to hire me. I had wanted to work for General Electric all my life. I can remember when I was a grade school student in approximately the fourth grade at Marriott School in Weber County, Utah. My teacher at that time, Miss Beulah Stallings, who taught grades 3, 4, and 5 all in the same classroom, had asked the students what they wanted to be when they grew up. I told her I wanted to be an electrical engineer and work for General Electric. Well, it turned out that although I dabbled in areas related to electrical engineering and actually spent time as a radar officer in the Navy, having had training at Bowdoin College, MIT, Harvard, and other places in electronics, it turned out that when I went back to school after World War II, I returned to chemistry and obtained a PhD in that field. Well, after this interviewing trip, I returned back to Salt Lake City and waited for offers. I pretty soon had offers from all the companies except General Electric. I kept waiting and hoping to hear from General Electric. Finally wrote to them or called to them, and they said they were still considering things. Finally, a phone call to the chemistry department came to me from Schenectady, New York. At the time, I happened to be in the library, and the call somehow was transferred over there. Glenn W. Giddings, who at that time was the recruiter for the research lab of the General Electric Company, was on the phone and told me that they were offering me a job at $6,200 a year. I later learned that my counterparts who were being hired at this same time, who were graduating from Princeton and Harvard and MIT and Yale, were being offered $5,700 a year. I attribute the differential to the fact that I was a few years older, had served in the war, and also had received a tremendously good recommendation from Henry Eyring. I had been interested in inorganic systems, having done part of my thesis work on the isomers of tromic salts, and wanted to continue to pursue some work in this field. General Electric, in spite of the fact that they had said a fellow could do anything that he wanted on coming to the search laboratory, soon was trying to push me into areas of practical interest to the company. I contended that there might be some interest in inorganic polymers of chromium or aluminum or other things that we might work on. They definitely weren't interested in having me pursue this sort of thing. It's interesting, however, that as years went by, there was a point when they asked me if I wouldn't like to work in the inorganic polymer area. This was at a time when I'd become interested in other things, and of course at that point did not want to. The first work of significance that I did in the research laboratory was in connection with polytrifluoroethylene materials. These materials nowadays are known by the trade name Cal-F. The company was interested in finding a solvent for these particular polymers in order that they might be coated on wire by evaporation of the solvent, and for other reasons. Also, there was no way to measure molecular weight of these materials because there was no solvent for them. I was able to make a study of the solubility of these polymers from a theoretical point of view after having read a book on solubility by Hildebrand. Also, I discovered that the quantity known as the solubility parameter was the thing that would determine solvents for this material, and that materials that had solubility parameters around those of carbon tetrachloride would act as solvents. Now, it turned out that the polymer could only be dissolved at an elevated temperature. It would not dissolve in carbon tetrachloride at any temperature to which carbon tet could be subjected at room pressure. But I discovered that by putting carbon tet under pressure, I could get to a high enough temperature to readily dissolve the polymer. And by this means, I was able to select some available organic solvents as the other materials that would dissolve the polymer. I wrote this article up for one of the scientific journals. It happened to be reviewed by Hildebrand before publication, and he wrote a nice letter to me commending me on fine piece of scientific research involved that was of practical interest. This buoyed my ego a great deal at that point in my life. I continued to work on various aspects of this polymer, measured its molecular weight by a light scattering technique at elevated temperatures under moderate pressure. And I also did other things. There's a point where they were interested in the cut-through of wires that were coated with this particular polymer. Along in 1951, Chauncey Guy Suits, the director of research for the company, decided that it was time for the research laboratory to take a look at the synthesis of diamonds. Zay Jeffries of the Carbaloy Company had, before World War II, been interested in this problem, and he and others in the company had solicited the help of Percy Bridgman in trying to synthesize diamonds. This was a joint venture with the Carboranda Company and the Norton Company. As I understand it, $100,000 was spent without success. A lot of the money was spent for a special hydraulic press that was that later ended up in the Norton Company, where they proceeded to continue the research. The problem was placed in the mechanical investigations section of the chemistry department. A.L. Marshall was head of the chemistry department. A.J. Tony Nerad was manager of the mechanical investigations department. At this time, I was in the physical chemistry department under Leibovsky. Herman Leibovsky. Two of the physicists in the mechanical investigation section, Herbert M. Strong and Francis P. Bundy, were asked to survey the literature to see what others had done. They spent approximately a year in conducting this survey. At this point, they issued a report to the company management of what had been done and outlined some procedures that might be followed in some new attempts based on the use of some of Bridgman's high-pressure equipment. At this point, company officials decided they should have two chemists working on the project. The physical chemists and inorganic chemists in the company were called into a meeting where problem was discussed, and the question was asked as to who among these chemists might be interested in working on the project. I was the only one that was interested. The rest of the men considered working on diamonds to be a crackpot venture in view of the long crackpot history of scientists working on diamonds for over 100 years. Since I was the only one interested, I got the job. At this point, I thought I was still working for Leibhosky, and Leibhosky didn't know where I was working, and later on I learned that Tony Neerad figured I was working for him. But anyway, for some period of time, there was some uncertainty as to whether I was continuing to work in the physical chemistry section or in the mechanical investigation section. Later on, I believe about a year later, a second chemist, Robert Wintorf, who had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin, was also hired to work on the project. Now, during the early days of the project, I spent my time reading the scientific literature on what people had claimed to have done on diamonds, and doing some additional thinking about the problem. I say additional thinking because diamonds had interested me from the time I had worked on my master's degree at the University of Utah. At that time, I had read considerably in the old scientific literature about diamonds and had thought quite a bit about making diamonds or about making boron, a solid crystalline boron that I thought might be as hard as diamonds. This was in the days when it was not certain that anyone had ever prepared pure boron, and certainly no one had prepared it in anything but an amorphous form at that time. The work seemed to divide itself into two natural categories. It was obvious that there was no high-pressure, high-temperature equipment available that would reach pressures and temperatures of the magnitude that might be necessary to synthesize diamonds. Also, it was apparent that it might not be possible to transform diamond directly, or transform graphite directly to diamond at the pressures and temperatures that we might be able to achieve. It might be possible to use a carbon-containing compound to produce diamond plus other products. Such a reaction might require a lower pressure and a lower temperature than would be required for the direct conversion from graphite. Also, there were questions about the rate of the reaction. Geologists had said hundreds of thousands or millions of years to make diamonds in nature. And of course, if we're going to make them in the laboratory, we would only be interested in making them in a very rapid period. At that time, we thought maybe if you grow a diamond in a couple of weeks, that might be all right. So one of the objectives was to devise high-pressure, high-temperature equipment that might get somewhere, say, in the neighborhood of 35,000 atmospheres and maybe a temperature of 1,000 degrees C or so. And this would be a great step forward, and it might be possible to synthesize diamonds under these conditions. Now, it seemed that the logical men to work on the high-pressure equipment were the two physicists, Strong and Bundy, and they were given this assignment. Strong and Bundy had been working on what was known as the P-Zero project. This was a project to use vacuum as refrigerator insulation. Strong continued on this project for a while as Bundy went off onto the Diamond Project thinking about apparatus. Bundy came up with a device that was a modified version of a hollowed out anvil that Bridgman had described. Now Bridgman had worked with these flat anvils, and then in trying to increase his volume, had hollowed out the anvils, but had left the angles sharp. Now Bundy, in a logical fashion, rounded these sharp angles so that the stresses would be much more uniformly distributed. Bundy called this thing the saucer apparatus. Bundy has never published any details of this saucer device, but I described it in my General Electric Research Laboratory report, number RL-1064, which was published in March of 1954. This particular report was rigidly limited in its distribution within the General Electric Company. It was a Class 4 report, which was their highest secrecy category. This report, which was entitled The Belt, Ultra-High Pressure, High-Temperature Apparatus, was finally released for publication in a journal in 1960. Well, Bundy's saucer was capable of reaching pressures of the order of 35,000 atmospheres simultaneously with temperatures of about 2,500 degrees centigrade. The working volume was extremely tiny. There was some indication that these pressures and temperatures should be high enough to convert graphite to diamond, but in practice this did not occur. Now, Bundy and Strong, together with their laboratory assistant, Jim Cheney, Wentorf and I did not have an assistant. Strong and Bundy also had a second assistant, Hal Bovenkirk, who was working on the P-Zero project and later worked on the Diamond project. Strong and Bundy on failing to make graphite go directly to diamond in the saucer apparatus began to fiddle around with various chemical systems, which was supposed to be our assignment. After some time they had no success with this, and became discouraged, and at this point was possible for Wentorf and I to start using this equipment. Now, each of us who had been fooling around with various chemical systems tried these chemical systems under pressure without any success, and after a while we too became discouraged. At this point, it seemed like equipment that would reach still higher pressures and temperatures had to somehow be developed. Strong and Bundy had, for a long time, had an eye on the double-acting piston, I shouldn't say double-acting, I should say on the two-stage piston and cylinder device that Bridgman had used at pressures to 100,000 atmospheres. Now, the inner piston in this device of Bridgman's was only 1/16 of an inch in diameter, but at least it had been to these tremendous pressures, and Strong and Bundy thought that it wouldn't be too big of a job to scale up the size of this apparatus so that the inside piston were, say, something like 1/4 inch in diameter. And then heat the interior of this device in some manner, and thus get to higher pressures in a reasonably large system. Actually, the saucer system had much too tiny a volume in addition to not getting to the desired pressures. Well, now, this two-stage piston device of Bridgman's would require what is known as a double-acting press for its operation. And it would require a rather large press, tonnage-wise, in order that the inner piston might have a diameter of the order of 1/4 inch or so. Well, this was talked about, and it was decided to buy such a double-acting press. This double-acting press was to cost something in the neighborhood of $150,000, and this was without Bridgman's two-stage piston cylinder device, which yet had not been designed in the larger size. Well, permission had to be obtained at this time anyway, from the president of the company to buy a piece of capital equipment for the research laboratory that cost more than $25,000. Well, permission was granted, and the die was set, and things were to go this way. While the press was under construction, which was going to take a year and a half or two, Strong and Bundy were to design this two-stage piston and cylinder apparatus to be placed in the press at the time the press arrived. Well, this made a long wait ahead of us, and so we each went off working on other things. I know that Bundy was working on turbine bearings, as well as going back to additional work on the P-Zero project. I believe I continued some additional work on polytetrafluoroethylene, cut through on of insulation on wires, I believe. I also worked on a humidity control for basement dehumidifiers that were becoming popular at that time due to the humid condition that you have in basements in the eastern part of the country. In about December of 1952, while pondering the problem of an apparatus that might have a fairly large volume and get to higher pressures than Bridgman's or than Bundy's saucer apparatus, and trying to think of something that we might get into operation right away without waiting all this long period of time for this double-acting press, I came up with an idea for a device that was later known as the half belt. We did have a hydraulic press available. It was an old Watson-Stillman press that utilized water as the hydraulic fluid. This had been around the company for at least 30 years and was used in compressing powdered tungsten for the experiments that were being done to learn how to draw tungsten into wires. This particular press had a side ram on it as well as a regular ram that operated downward from above. This press was in terrible condition. Leaked water all over from the pullback rams that are located up on top and everywhere. Water just ran out from pipes everywhere. But this is the press that was being used to operate Bundy's saucer up. Now, since I didn't have the calling to design apparatus, I approached Bundy with my idea. He was semi-enthused. At least he was willing to help me get it constructed. I did not have a shop order on which apparatus could be constructed, and you had to have a shop order to get work done in the GE machine shop. So this device, which I have described originally in this GE report number RL-1064, of which I have a copy, and which I've already mentioned, was later published in the Review of Scientific Instruments,